Good evening. Welcome both to our local audience and our C-SPAN audience. Tonight, the forum asks, what can be done about unjust convictions? What are the causes? What are the remedies? In a sense, this discussion is long overdue. The problem has surely existed as long as the criminal justice system itself. However, only recently have these questions begun to attract widespread national attention, leading most dramatically to the recently announced death penalty moratorium in the state of Illinois. The forum tonight brings together six expert panelists in what we expect to be an enlightening discussion of this important topic. There will be a chance for audience questions. Out of respect to our C-SPAN audience, we ask that when you're called upon, do wait for the microphone to be brought to you, please. It gives me great pleasure at this time to introduce our moderator for tonight's program, the Weld Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and the Director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society here at Harvard Law School, Professor Charles Nesson.
Law flies under the flag of truth. When we come to the conclusion of a trial, the end product is a verdict. Verdict means something. It comes from the Latin, to speak truth. This book, Actual Innocence, written by three of our panelists, suggests a thesis that the flag under which law flies is false. In fact, when you look at the evidence, there is no great connection, at least not nearly as great as we may have thought, between verdict as truth and verdict as simply the end of a process, the value of which is to come to a conclusion. So we're here tonight to talk about a quite extraordinary event. It's the event of, well, here. I hold a quarter in my hand. Let's do a symbolic trial. There was the event. Which hand did Nesson put the quarter in? How should we decide? Well, we could pry my hand open and see. But in the real world, when there's a murder or an automobile accident and a controversy comes up that is not subject to resolution by any other method, everything has failed before people go to court. We do it by trial. What is this process of ours? Well, first, we select a jury, representative of the community, a jury of peers, our peers. And then we call witnesses, eyewitnesses, each of you, eyewitnesses. Barry, which hand did Nesson put the quarter in?
Clueless. Looked like the right.
Which hand, Barry?
I thought it was the right.
The right hand. Your witness. Right? That's the way it goes. And then the lawyer for the left hand gets up and says, I heard you say clueless, Ms. Check. You didn't really see it, did you?
No.
And we proceed through each and every eyewitness that the prosecution chooses to produce and the defense chooses to produce. And when we get all through, we leave it to you, the jury. We put you in a box, a room that's closed, and we say, you decide, and you don't get to go home until you do. And at the end of the process, we announce your verdict. So Barry, tell us, how did the Innocence Project get started?
Well, Peter Neufeld and I used to be public defenders in the South Bronx. And I began teaching at Cardozo Law School, and our old public defender's office referred to us a case of an individual who had been convicted and they all thought he was innocent. He had 11 alibi witnesses. He was in another part of the Bronx. And we tried to do DNA testing in that case in 1988-89. And there was not enough sample to get a result, but nobody had really been interested, or it was new, in DNA testing. And so we learned a lot about it. And over the course of time, we just were educated by some wonderful scientists and learned that DNA testing has this unique property where you can go back and look at evidence that is 10, 20, 30 years old, and you can suddenly speak the truth in a trial where the defendant kept on claiming I'm innocent and nonetheless was convicted, sentenced to life in prison or death row. And so we began taking cases only on the basis of whether or not a DNA test could prove innocence, and in they came from inmate after inmate, family after family, and exonerations began to pile up, and it spread across to the country to the point now where there are 64 exonerations in the United States and 6 in Canada for a total of 70 in North America since really 1992.
So suddenly DNA technology emerges onto the scene, and trials which have been done and cooked and appealed and habeased and processed to death, suddenly, instead of nobody really knowing which hand the coin is in, suddenly DNA comes along well after the fact and pries my hand open, and there it is. It's in the left hand all the time. Even though the verdict was right because they believed you.
That's exactly what happened.
So, Peter, tell us. You did. Left hand.
He lost the case.
What's the significance of this? Why is this interesting to us? What gathers us here tonight?
Well, I mean, DNA simply was a rather trivial solution to the problem of unjust convictions. The much more perplexing problem, the one I think that drove the three of us to write this book, is not so much how they got out, but how these 70 people got into prison in the first place. What systems failed in criminal justice that allowed this many innocent people to be convicted, and in the case of 8 of them, to be sentenced to death? And by the way, don't think it's simply 70 people. In the first place, in 75% of the cases that we get at the Innocence Project, we simply have to close them out because the biological evidence has been lost or destroyed. More importantly, over the last decade, on average, the FBI, in cases sent to their laboratory for DNA testing where a person has already been arrested based on eyewitness identification, based on circumstantial evidence, in the thousands of cases that have gone to them, they've excluded the primary suspect in 25% of the time. You can easily...
Wait, let me get that. They've got a primary suspect. If they didn't have DNA testing, they would have just gone right ahead with the primary suspect.
The primary suspect's already been arrested in these cases that went to the FBI. The person was arrested based on, for instance, eyewitness identification.
But the fact that they've got DNA test available, they take the opportunity to send it in, see if... And you clear 25% of them?
25% of those people have been cleared at the FBI, at the private laboratories, at the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Laboratory in Canada, and at the appropriate government laboratories in Great Britain.
So what do you draw from that? What's the significance of that?
Significance of that is that, frankly, thank God they had DNA testing, but for all those folks who went to trial on the same evidence prior to the development of DNA testing, there's a substantial likelihood that thousands of those people were unjustly convicted based simply on the strengths of such things as a sincere victim saying, I will never forget that face.
So you're suggesting that there may be a class of cases in which the error rate could possibly be as high as 25%?
Well, no. I mean, we're proving that there is a definite class of cases where there just so happens to be biological evidence. And we can say, here are people that were arrested and indicted for rape and rape murder, and DNA excludes them. How many of them would have been convicted if they went to trial without DNA testing? We don't know. If you only
my conviction rate as a prosecutor is damn near 100%.
Well, in these categories of crimes, ordinarily it's something on the order of 70% in many jurisdictions or higher, but these people are presumably innocent. They're innocent. So I like to believe in our system that the innocent do get convicted less frequently than the guilty. Nonetheless, if you even hypothesize 1%, a half of 1% of people being convicted, right, who DNA could prove innocent, that still translates to thousands of people. But the bigger question, the more important question is, what about all those people that go to trial based on the same eyewitness identification, jailhouse snitch testimony, junk forensic science, prosecutorial misconduct, police misconduct, bad lawyers? What about all those people in those kinds of situations? Because these are the causes of wrongful convictions where there is no biological evidence. That's what the DNA testing is proving. That's what it's showing. That's the message to which attention must be paid.
Mr. Dwyer, how'd you meet up with these fellows? What's your connection here?
Somebody threw a bunch of legal papers on my desk at a newspaper office 9 years ago and said, read this, see if there's something there. If there isn't, throw them out. And I started to read on a long bus ride home the story of a man who had been convicted 11 years earlier. And the first part of the story was that, or the first part of the legal papers said, we want a new trial. We have new evidence that this guy is innocent that wasn't available before he was tried or at the time of his trial. And here's the evidence. The first piece was that the eyewitness said at the trial that she knew beyond all doubt the minute she laid eyes on him that he was the guy. And they've now found a piece of paper that shows that originally when she first laid eyes on him, she said it looks like the guy. She didn't say beyond all doubt. And I read that and I said, eh, not that interesting. It's sort of interesting. It's not enough to turn this case around. Then the second thing, the second piece of newly discovered evidence was that the man had an alibi defense. And he said at certain times he could prove that he was at a bank, he was in a lawyer's office, he was in places where he was documented that made him unavailable for the crime. And they showed that there was a document the police had turned over to the defense that had been altered to make him more available, to make his alibi less valid, and therefore not as airtight as it had once seemed. And so that was a more potent, but still, there was enough time in there. Maybe people were a little wrong about the time of the crime. Who knew for sure? Then the third piece of newly discovered evidence was this incredible story that they could use biological tests to look at something that was 11 years old, a rape kit that had been sitting in the Suffolk County storage lockers in Long Island, and that with this test, they could suddenly tell you what nobody had been able to see 11 years before, which was that this man's DNA was not in the semen left by the rapist. I thought this was ridiculous. I had taken some biology and even escaped with my life in college, and I thought stuff broke down. Then you start to read about this DNA test that they were speaking about, and it's used in laboratories all over the world to do HIV testing. It's used to help people make transplant matches. It's used to test fossils that are millions of years old, not 11 years old. And suddenly I went back and said, this eyewitness thing, maybe they were really right. This alibi issue, this misconduct where they switched the times around a little bit, it looks a little more serious to me. And it happened over the next 9-10 years. We kept talking and speaking about these cases, and the lives of the people who had been affected by eyewitnesses that I would have shrugged at had there not been DNA proof, police misconduct that I would have just said, look, it's all in a day's work, all that stuff started to become much more important.
Mr. Dwyer.
Yeah.
The question was, how'd you meet these guys?
And then I got off the bus on the way home and I called them up.
All right. All right, so now if I'm hearing it right, what I'm getting from Barry is this problem of distortion in the system or inaccuracy, let's just call it that, is not limited to rape cases or cases where DNA evidence is, any limits on it, Barry, at all? Is it, Are we just, this is our process. This is the trial system. This is the eyewitness, prosecutorial, defense, jury system.
This is the system, but by the time you get to the jury, it's a bit too late. Because when you look at the causes of wrongful convictions and the solutions that we try to put forward here, which we think Republicans and Democrats, prosecutors and defense lawyers can get behind, they're systemic. They are saying this is the way to do identifications better, to minimize false hits while in no way reducing the number of true hits. This is the way to get reliable interrogations where you don't get false interrogations. This is the way to do forensic science so it's not junk. This is the way to do these things so that we literally are exonerating the innocent, and every time you exonerate the innocent, it gives you a better chance to catch the real guilty party before he goes out and commits other crimes. So the public safety argument here is so critical. It's a win-win for law enforcement. They should adopt every recommendation, even though we made them.
So, Bill Kovach, you're a journalist. You're in the rhetorical business. I think law is a rhetorical enterprise. I think law puts out stories that people can accept as truth. It's a competitor for truth with journalism and science and other engines for identifying what's real around us. And here what's described is law at risk of losing its credibility, actually losing its credibility. The idea that verdict is no longer something that we can actually accept as true. What should we do about it? What's your thought?
Well, one, I think we begin with Barry's recommendations. I think there's some extraordinary recommendations in here about how the investigation and prosecution of crime should be conducted. From my perspective, from a journalist perspective, what can journalism do in this atmosphere? I think journalists should read this book, take advantage of the knowledge in here, and think about the way we cover criminal law, the way we cover crime and prosecution. Most often, the first stories are the stories controlled by the police, the district attorney's office, both of whom have a vested interest in making sure that the audience out there from which the jury will eventually be drawn has a certain sense of this case. The degree to which journalists allow themselves to become agents by extension of the prosecution without balance, without careful consideration of the alternative story, is the degree to which journalism participates in building the problem that this book deals with. False witness, prosecutorial misconduct, the withholding of evidence, issues like that should be the natural focus of a good investigative journalism. It's often not possible because the only sources of information at the beginning of a crime are the people who have an interest in shaping your outlook, the public's outlook.
Well, let me be more specific. Uh-huh. Let's just make it hypothetical. Imagine I'm the law lord. Somehow personify the law. I'm the law lord. And I'm upset because my credibility has been impeached. My power will decline. My persuasive ability is already in some disarray, what with junk science from the scientific community and exposés from the journalist community. And here, suddenly, our own lawyers, minions, my minions, have gone out and demonstrated that my verdicts are a fraud. What should I do? Advise me. Where do I go? How do I regain my credibility?
Well, I think you do the same thing a lot of journalists are trying to do now to regain credibility for journalism, is you examine your fundamental principles, articulate those principles clearly, and make sure you abide by them and live by them.
See, that's my trouble.
What
my fundamental principles are. What is law about? Is law about truth?
If it's not about a pursuit of truth, it has no reason for being.
Well, if I was truthful, maybe I should stop teaching the world that what we're interested in is truth. Maybe I should just explain that truth is nice. We prefer it to falsehood. We have a preference for it. But the fact is, what we're really doing is resolving disputes. Society brings their controversies to us, criminal and civil. We grind them through this amazing machine of ours. We turn out resolution, and our society marches on. Maybe we should just teach people that so that they're not expecting so much truth. What do you think?
No, I disagree. I mean, that may be what is being done, but I don't think that's the goal. I think the pursuit of truth in every case should be the goal of the legal profession, just as the pursuit of the best possible truth should be the goal of every journalist who goes out after a story. Now, you're not always going to get it, but that should be the goal, and that should be the pursuit, and then everything should be designed to accomplish that end. I can give you one specific example just from another panel I was on recently about this subject, where I think something could be done. The journalist who did the series of stories in Chicago that led the governor there to stop executing people on death row, because while they executed 12, they exonerated 13. That's not a good batting average for people on death row. But as they, and a number of these cases, I've forgotten the percentage, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% were innocent people who were on death row convicted because of prosecutorial misconduct. But when they went to examine what happened to the prosecutors who were misconducting themselves, they found that the court that reversed the conviction expunged the prosecutor's name so no one could find out who had failed to pursue truth. I would think a profession that cared about its integrity would not allow a system to function that way. As a matter of fact, they did find out who they were, and 40% of them were on the bench now. They had created a great reputation as diligent prosecutors sufficient to be elected to the bench. So I think you start with things like that.
So this is a sparmy story, isn't it? This is a tough story. Now, what you're telling me is that a governor of one of the states of the United States has actually declared that the state justice system, which in structure is no different from any other state justice system, is so bad that they've got to stop the process of killing people. That's what you're telling me.
That's exactly what happened, and I think, I mean, the book makes the point over and over. I mean, there's no question we're in a state of crisis.
So, Mike Seidman, I'm the governor of Illinois. I got a problem. I stopped this process. I got a lot of press for it. It was really great. They never expected me to do it, because I'm Republican. But, whoa, I'm a national figure now. But I got a problem, Mike. How do I start it up again?
Right. Before I answer that, speaking of truth, I do have to say truthfully, I was a little disappointed with how this forum started, because I was absolutely sure from what I know about Professor Nesson that he was going to make the quarter disappear altogether. And could you do that for us? Or?
Thank you.
You said a moment ago that the criminal justice system, the crisis is that it's losing its credibility. I actually think the problem is the opposite, that it hasn't lost as much of its credibility as it ought to have. And that's the problem the governor of Illinois faces, I think. I think this is a great book, and what's even greater in some sense is the effort that Shack and Newfield have gone through to do this work. The book, though, does obscure a hard truth. The focus on individual defendants obscures a hard truth. The hard truth is that if we're going to have a criminal justice system at all, there has to be an optimal level of innocent people who are convicted. If you think about it for a moment, the only way to prevent innocent people from being convicted would not be to have a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. It would be to have a beyond all doubt standard. And if we had that, we wouldn't convict anyone. So and whether we have an optimal level or not is a political judgment in the end, how many guilty people we want to convict and how many innocent people we want to convict. I think the real problem is, and the problem the governor of Illinois faces, is that there is so, the criminal justice system is so entrenched with legitimacy. There is such a strong sense that it never convicts anybody who's innocent, that it's very hard to generate an accurate political judgment about this political question. And so the question is, what do we do about that? Part of what we do about that is read this book. I do have to say, though, as somebody who thinks of himself as a criminal justice liberal, I think part of the blame actually has to reside with criminal justice liberals, and in particular with the defense of a strong adversary system that they put in place. And the reason I think that is because it's created a popular perception, a very wrong popular perception, that anybody who gets through this system with all of these bleeding heart judges defending their rights, giving them lawyers, suppressing evidence, anybody who gets through that system must be guilty. And it's just not true. And I think actually part of the blame for that is a kind of miscalculation that was made by the Warren Court about the costs and benefits of putting in place some of the things that have been put in place.
Peter, jump in. Actually, the governor goes a step further towards solving the problem. Because not only did he declare a moratorium, but he also announced the creation of a commission. And this commission is going to have the purpose of looking back at those 13 exonerations, those 13 people who walked off of death row, to try and figure out what went wrong in the system that led to those unjust convictions. One of the key recommendations that we make in this book as well is for the creation of something which we call innocence commissions. And it goes something like this. If in this country, if a plane crashes to the ground, or if a train derails, or if there's an unexpected death of a patient in a hospital, we institutionally go back and do some kind of retrospective analysis of what went wrong. Was it individual error? Was it systemic failure? Was it a fluke? And not only do we do that, but we then also try and come up with recommendations to prevent the reoccurrence of this tragedy. Well, the only system in this country that doesn't do that is the criminal justice system. Because in each and every one of these cases where there's been obviously a disaster, the innocent person was convicted, and in several instances sentenced to death, there is not a word written about why they got unjustly convicted. In almost every one of these cases, the defendant makes a motion to vacate the conviction based on DNA evidence. The prosecution, in most instances, does their own DNA test to replicate the results. And then the judge simply writes one line vacating the conviction and dismissing the charges. So unless we go back and roll up our sleeves and make this kind of important inquiry that's made in every different system in this country but criminal justice, then we are doomed to repeat these failures in the future.
Dick Lewinton, you're a scientist. Yes?
So I understand.
You think of yourself that way.
That's what I'm paid to do, yes.
And you have your methodology for finding truth.
Yes. What flows from that? Are you asking me whether the methodologies which we use are infallible or even extraordinarily good ways of finding out what's true? The answer is no, because in most cases we can't get the kind of evidence that a really hard-minded trier of fact would accept as being demonstration of truth. There's a great deal of backing and filling, of appeal to popular notions of what might be true and so on. No, I wouldn't suggest that science has a method which is guaranteed to find the truth about the world.
Not guaranteed, yes. But highly respected, believed in, credible in the world. But I'm not interested in that so much as I'm interested in your scientist view of this process. You've seen the way DNA has been used in trials. You see the way trial tries to come to truth. Talk to us about that.
Well, I think I have a slightly different take on it than what's been said so far. The lesson I drew from Jim and Peter and Barry's book was a rather different one, because you will remember that a number of the persons unjustly convicted were not simply unjustly convicted on the basis of eyewitness misidentification, but in fact in several cases as a consequence of the testimony of so-called expert witnesses, who actually turned out to be either fraudulent or sloppy. I think one has to understand that we are not faced with a situation that scientific evidence, on the one hand, confronts approximate or folk wisdom or visual identifications on the other, and therefore can be counted on to correct those errors, because many of the errors are a consequence, in fact, of the introduction of what is supposed to be scientific evidence, but is either poorly done or done in bad faith or simply lies. For me, the lesson is that the introduction of so-called scientific methods into the law is in some sense potentially more destabilizing. And that is because science has a credibility, which was suggested in your question, even though you may not have be so credulous. So that if I, as an expert, get on the stand, and I have been an expert, and am qualified by the court after an hour of asking about my credentials and so on, why then what I say as a scientific expert has an extraordinary credibility to the triers of fact. Well beyond what the eyewitness has, because after all, we all know that eyewitnesses make mistakes. We all know that people mistake one for another, but surely a scientist or an expert doesn't make that mistake. So the real problem we have is that the rate at which such errors of judgment are made is in fact in part increased by the use of experts and scientific evidence, even though we have scientific methods for then counterposing against those. But you have to put yourself in the position of the trier of fact, who does not understand probabilities, who does not understand chemistry, who does not understand basic cell biology, and is confronted with a professor from Harvard who assures them that his or her scientific work has demonstrated beyond a reasonable, even beyond any scientific doubt, that this fellow really did it, because the chance is only 1 in 37 million that it could have been somebody else. DNA is a two-edged sword, and in a sense, it's proper, in a sense, that DNA evidence be used against DNA evidence. It's proper that expert evidence be used against expert evidence, but the existence of expertise is a problem for the law and for the trier of fact, which presents us with new questions that we ought to explore. Look, this problem goes back to Plato. I mean, in the Gorgias, Plato discusses the problem of experts in a democratic society and says, look, we have a democratic society. What is the trier of fact supposed to do? You don't expect him just to believe the Joe off the street. Well, of course he's supposed to believe the expert. And that gives an immense power to the expert, which I find very dangerous and very destabilizing of justice.
Experts are funny things, aren't they?
No.
It's a business, isn't it? You make your living being an expert witness. Your customers, who's the customer for the expert witness? I'm a professional forensic expert witness. I make my living doing it. Who are my customers? Who is on the other end of the phone when it rings? I hope. It's lawyers, right?
Lawyers who have the money to hire you.
Right.
Which excludes many public defenders, for example.
Right. If I make my living being an expert for the prosecution, then the business I'm in is telling winning stories for prosecutors.
Ah, I disagree.
Are you disagreeing as a matter of fact or as a matter of
principle, ideal? A matter of ideals.
It shouldn't be that way.
It should not be that way.
But yet, Barry.
Barry, look, let me tell you my experience as an expert witness. I've been an expert witness, as you know, a couple of times, and once...
I think we called you.
Yeah, you called me, yes. And I was asked by the opposing attorney whether I was being paid for my testimony. And I replied in all three cases in which I have served truthfully, no, I have not been paid. I have done this pro bono. And the next question asked was, well, if you're not being paid, then what's in it for you, and why have you come all the way from Boston to California or Ohio, wherever it is? You must have some hidden agenda. And that's a problem for the expert. If you get paid, they say you're a hired gun. And if you don't get paid, you must have a hidden agenda.
Why did you do it?
Because I had an agenda. But I'll reveal it to you.
Please.
It was a desire to make sure that the power of the state to marshal scientific evidence not go unchallenged. That's an ideological agenda.
Peter, tell us the experience of coming up with this evidence. You've got it, okay? You've looked back. You've gotten the evidence out of the locker. It's old, it's moldy, you send it off to the lab. Wow, it comes through, you prove that the defendant is innocent.
Well, first we got to get it from the laboratory.
Well, I'm interested in what happens when you get it. My question is, what is the reaction? Now you've got it. Now you run into court and you say, hey, what happens?
Well, I mean, sometimes the reaction is, this is wonderful, you've helped to vindicate an innocent person, and we will join you in moving to see this person's freedom achieved. However, there are a number of situations where we have not been met with that kind of response, where prosecutors will say, aha, obviously the evidence is tainted.
Do it for me this way, would you? Play it out with Barry. Barry, would you be the prosecutor?
He does that. He actually does a good job of playing.
Yes, yes. Here's the scene. Peter comes into your office. He's got the file with him. He's managed to get it from the lab. We'll find out about that problem in a minute. And he's got the goods. He can prove that Joe is innocent. Talk to him for me.
Well, you see, in this rape case, we have a clear DNA exclusion that Mr. Johnson couldn't possibly have been the rapist in this case. And we want you to join us in the motion before the court to release Mr. Johnson.
Wait just a second. I have to go back. I have to talk to the victim. I have to do some further investigation of this case. And I'm going to go back, not in this conversation, but in the next one, and I'm going to tell him, well, I've spoken to the victim in this case, and there may be a possibility that there were other people with whom she had sex that weren't originally revealed. And
you mean, Barry, that the guy who did it is still out there? That's what you're trying to tell
me?
No,
I'm saying that she might have had some prior consensual partners within the last 24 to 48 hours, and that may be the reason that the DNA that you got from the semen that was found on the vaginal swab in this case doesn't belong to your client who still did it, but he wore a condom or he didn't ejaculate, that's the problem.
But when the victim testified at trial, she swore under oath that she had not had consensual sex with anybody during the preceding week, and that in fact the only person she had sex with was her husband, and he was away, on a business trip at the time.
Well, you've conveniently put something in the transcript that I didn't see. Nobody bothered to ask that question.
But that's the nature of this forum here. You just got to understand that.
All right.
That's the way that... What I'm driving at is, you're the prosecutor, Barry. Are you resistant to this? Are you fighting it?
Yeah. It's about a 50-50 proposition. Some prosecutors will go, I'm really disturbed to hear this, but I live by DNA. We die by DNA if it's a wrong conviction. Perish the thought that we ever execute anybody who's innocent. I will fix the situation. Others will say, it's hard for me to believe. There must be another explanation. Your client, there's other evidence. He has a prior record or whatever it is. I just don't believe this. There must be another explanation, and whatever that might be, I'm going to try to find it. And so the witness was embarrassed about saying that she had another prior consensual partner. Let's go out and find that person, or I'm not even going to bother to go out and find that person.
But Mr. Scheck, you told me at trial, and you told the jury at trial during the summation, that you held up this rape kit, and you had done conventional ABO testing, and you told the entire jury that the semen found in that rape kit by the scientist came from my client, that very semen, based on ABO testing. If you made that representation to the jury as part of your theory of the case, aren't you bound by that now as I make a motion to set aside the conviction?
Well, there was a lot of other evidence in the case, too. There was circumstantial evidence. There was eyewitness evidence. What really matters is whether or not this evidence in and of itself, this DNA exclusion, proves that your client is absolutely innocent. If it's a possibility that there's another person who's responsible for that semen who is not the defendant and obviously didn't commit the rape, still means your client could be guilty. And as long as your client could still be guilty, I am not going to vacate this conviction. You have to prove to me that he's actually innocent beyond any doubt before this system can allow this conviction to go away.
But
can I ask a question as a lay person? Given the nature of the opposition between the task of the prosecutor and the task of the defense attorney, isn't the prosecutor under some obligation to resist, not to refuse to ever change, but at least to put up some resistance?
They're not obliged to resist. They can resist if they think it's the right thing to do. That's they're not supposed to resist in each and every case like mules kicking.
But let's understand their dilemma, Mr. Dwyer. They've convicted someone.
Yeah.
There's a family and a community that's upset by some really serious crime.
Yeah.
And they've been in doubt about it, and then they've gone through this incredibly cathartic process of a trial. They've come to the conviction, it's been resolved, it's been dead, it's been buried. We've been living with it for a long time, and we're happy. And now you're going to come along as a prosecutor, and you're going to have to gather us all together somehow and explain to us all of that was wrong, that the reality that we'd built our lives around since that conviction is wrong. I can see why you'd resist.
It's a tough day's work for the prosecutor, but it's nothing in reality next to what you've done to the guy you've sent away mistakenly.
Mike.
It's not just the community, by the way, and the victim. I do want to mention again what I think is just the corrosive effect of the adversary system. The prosecutor is up against someone whose job it is to get the person off by any legal means. And the person the prosecutor is up against is not especially concerned with getting at the truth. The defense attorney's job isn't to get at the truth, it's to get the client off. Prosecutors are human beings, and when the defense attorney is playing that role, it's very easy for the prosecutor to slip into an adversary role on the other side and consciously or unconsciously think that the thing to do is to make sure the person is convicted or stay convicted.
You know, what really happens most of the time in these cases is, I mean, there is this little back and forth, as Barry and Peter discussed, but what really happens is the prosecutor says, okay, let me have my lab check your results.
And, you know, they might hem and haw a little bit, but then when they check the results, they let the people out. This is not, I want to emphasize that the people that who were exonerated, these 70 people in North America, are not, in almost all cases, they're not controversial. They're not, there's no issue as to their innocence or guilt anymore. It's over with. Both sides go into court and move to vacate the conviction. Often enough, they then get the real guy. Not often enough. Sometimes they get the real guy. 15 times they've gotten serial killers or serial rapists as part of the exoneration process. So there is this contention, there is this adversarial stuff that goes on, but really the science actually does carry tremendous weight, and everybody gives it its due weight.
That's true, but I think if I can try to guess the hypothetical, I teach law myself sometimes for 22 years, there are some cases that are profoundly disturbing. They were chronicled in a wonderful documentary called The Case for Innocence by Ofer Pikkel. It was done for Frontline. It was broadcast actually January 11th. You can get it off your website. It profiles two cases that profoundly disturbed me. There's a man named Roy Kreiner who is in jail in Texas, and the DNA testing has shown that he could not have committed this rape homicide. And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, 6-3, reinstated his conviction after the trial judge threw it out, saying the DNA had proven it. Does not have a real remedy, because in the state of Texas, you have to get the prosecutor and the judge to agree to send it to a pardon board. And if the pardon board then agrees, they send it to Governor George Bush, and then he can think about it. And how are they going to get there?
And that takes a long time.
And not only that, why is the prosecutor running for re-election going to do it? There's another case in Virginia. There's a man named Earl Washington. We do write about him a bit in the book, but a man named Earl Washington who has a very low IQ. They had brought him in. He confessed to a whole series of crimes that he couldn't have committed. They cleared him of all of them because there was no way he could have committed them except for one, for which he was convicted and sentenced to death. And then DNA testing at the very last minute before Governor Wilder left office proved that he couldn't have committed this crime. But one set of tests that was utterly definitive was hidden from the lawyers that were working on his behalf, because Governor Wilder was going to run for the United States Senate, and he didn't want to have a Willie Horton potential situation if he were to let Earl Washington out of jail, or whatever his political calculations were. So even in these cases, and there are a number of them across the country, where the science has, in Dick Lewton's words, destabilized the system here by demonstrating actual innocence, still there is resistance in some of these cases, because it is an issue of legitimacy. It is the warlord who doesn't want to say, who doesn't take the approach that this is an opportunity to figure out how this system can do better, not eliminate completely mistakes, because you can never do that, but we can do a hell of a lot better. But political considerations, unfortunately, govern far too much for elected prosecutors, certainly elected judges and elected governors.
Mike, speaking of the law lord, page 71 of William Rehnquist is quoted. A claim of actual innocence is not itself a constitutional claim. Would you comment on that for us?
Well, Justice Rehnquist is one of my favorite people. Not really, actually, but I think that it really is a problem. I think we have every right to be outraged whenever any innocent person is in prison. And I think what Barry just said is absolutely right. We can do much better than we're doing. I think the real task is to change the political climate so that there will be a political will to do better. At the same time, and I think you were getting at this earlier, it is in some inevitable sense true that law is about process rather than end results, in the following sense. No matter how many hearings we go through, no matter how many tests are done, we are never absolutely sure of the outcome. Almost never, anyway. And so it can't be that the standard for when we're allowed to punish someone is that we are sure they are guilty. It has to be that at some point we say we've gone through adequate process, and now it's okay for us to do it, recognizing that there's going to be some error. The question is, how much process? I think Barry is absolutely right that we're not going through enough, and what we're going through is flawed. I think what we need to think harder about is why so many Americans don't agree with us, and what we can do to change that. And that's where I think, as I said earlier, that liberals like us bear some of the blame.
So let me turn that around. I'm John Q. Public. I live in a state of law and order. I like life around me, more or less. I look to the justice system as part of the police system, which keeps the order, and but for it, I see chaos. I want to believe in it. If I don't believe in it, I don't know quite what I do believe in. So I invest faith in it, and I resist people who come along and show me that it's a lie.
Well, that's the public, but shouldn't the system, shouldn't the legal system, shouldn't the lawyers in the process, shouldn't the bar and shouldn't the court worry about their credibility? And should, I mean, Barry seems to me had a very simple and would think effective suggestion, and that is, anytime for whatever reason, scientific evidence, prosecutorial misconduct, or whatever, that there be an examination about why the system failed in this case and some action taken if there's a prosecutorial misconduct, police misconduct, or a failure of the system, some responsibility laid at someone's feet and something be done about it. I mean, to make it clear that the legal profession is not going to accept this kind of behavior.
So back to the law lord here. Here's the way I understand my problem now, Dick. You tell me if I've got it wrong. As long as we were dealing in a system where, when we did a trial, we got a verdict and nobody could ever figure out which hand it was really in, we could run a credible system because there was no way anybody could ever impeach our verdict. Worked fine. Then along came this problem. It's really a discontinuity in technology. It'll last for a while. Suddenly the curtain goes back and we see the law revealed for a while. But maybe we move into an era where we've learned to digest this DNA, at least well enough so that we don't convict people who are demonstrably innocent. And then we'll be back to business as usual. Does that sound right to you?
But all that this scientific evidence has done is to heighten what was already a deep contradiction in law. Indeed, I hear it in this room because the word law has two meanings. If I listened in this room, I would think that all that law was about was trials and finding of truths or bringing of verdicts. But of course, laws have an existence outside the courts. Indeed, the courts depend on the existence of laws, and those laws are created not for the purpose of justice. They are created for the purpose of order. I mean, you may not like that, but that is a deep contradiction in law, that laws are instituted, as Martin Luther said, justice was made for the sake of peace, not peace for the sake of justice. Justice has always been in part in contradiction with the ordering and function of the passage of laws. And all that science has done is to reveal more clearly the working of that contradiction, because the purpose of passing laws is not to find truth. The purpose of courts may be to find as much as possible the truth, but they support the existence of those laws whose purpose is order. And you can't escape from that contradiction. There's no escape from that contradiction. Innocent people will be convicted. Verdicts will be false dicts. And my point is that on the one hand, science can be used to reduce the frequency of those, but on the other hand, science also threatens to increase their frequency because of our reliance on experts whom we do not feel capable of challenging. And you can't make that contradiction go away.
So here we are at Harvard Law School. Students come here to learn to be lawyers. What should we be teaching? Should we be teaching a passion for justice? Is that part of being a lawyer? Or is that just a false thing that we're offering? Should we be teaching them instead that law is order with a patina?
No, it's not a patina. I think it is the obligation. Look, I think academics tried, being academics, to avoid facing contradictions in their system. The law has a deep contradiction in it, and the first thing that students have to understand is that those contradictions are not totally resolvable, but that as persons, as individuals, not lawyers, but as individuals devoted to the extent that they can be to justice, to social justice, to individual justice, they must constantly resist the false resolution of legal cases. But to pretend that we can find a magic formula that will somehow make that go away is foolish.
Mr. Dwyer.
Yeah, you can't teach a passion for justice. You can't teach a passion for women or wine or song. You either have it or you don't do it. Once you taste it, though, you want it. And when
you think you can teach people out of a passion?
You
can't
teach them.
We take in students who come here for justice, and we grind them through a process that turns them out to be white shoe lawyers.
Yeah. Let them taste injustice, even vicariously, through the lives of the people who have met it, and they will spit it out. They will not have it. I guarantee you that. When you meet the people, when you feel what they've gone through, or just a touch of what they've gone through, they're not going to settle for less. People are good. They are. Even lawyers.
In fact, what we're trying to do at this time and in this room, in part, is to help create what's known as a National Innocence Network, to give students at law schools all over the country and journalism schools an opportunity to start investigating these potential miscarriages of justice. And they don't have to be involved like the Innocence Project at Cardozo Law School is in 200 or 300 cases. It can be two cases, it can be one case. But if you are touched by that one case, and you played a role in exonerating an innocent person and walking that person out of prison or walking that person off of death row, certainly you will not only be saving that person's life, certainly you will be in a position to find out what went wrong in the system that gave rise to that unjust conviction, but you also will have the kind of transcendental experience that Jim Dwyer is talking about that will carry you through the rest of your life.
If I could, I want to say something here because I really disagree with a couple of things that have just been said. It seems to me law at its best, not the idealistic view, not the real view, but at its best, it reaches its potential when it's about neither justice nor order, but rather about destabilization, about disordering, if you will. What makes me very nervous when people say we want somebody to have a passion for justice, that's fine if they have my conception of justice, but those prosecutors who aren't releasing these people, they have a passion for justice, boy. They think, they are absolutely convinced that they're reaching just outcomes. That's why they don't want to release them. What law does at its best, I think, is it provides a mechanism for criticizing any position people take so that they are open-minded about things, so that when Barry or Peter comes in with the DNA evidence, they shake their head and say, you know, I thought this was true, but now I'm not so sure. And if I could put in a pitch for a much maligned institution, the Socratic method, it seems to me when the Socratic method is at its best, what it does is it destabilizes. Somebody stands up and they pretty clearly think X is right, and they're led through a series of questions to shake their head and say, you know, now I can really understand how somebody might think Y. I think that's what we ought to be teaching our students, and that's the function that law serves at its best.
But we can't overlook this rare window of opportunity that you described, because it is a magic moment, in a sense, in terms of looking at the law lord and the criminal justice system, because we do have this incredible series of exonerations where there are these people who are actually innocent, and so much of the system is laid bare. And it is a very, very special time for law students and journalism students and law professors and lawyers who care about fixing the system, because we see things now a little better than we're going to be able to see them when DNA is the routine part of it. And the lesson that we've learned in going across the country, and most of these innocence projects are not going to deal with DNA cases. They're going to deal with cases where people are just saying, I'm innocent, and you reinvestigate it, and you find out that it job wasn't done well in the first place, and it all of a sudden disappears. The best example for us are these people, and they are journalists, in Chicago, right? David Protest at Northwestern Journalism School and Larry Marshall at the law school. Here's a case that illustrates everything. Anthony Porter. Anthony Porter's a man on death row. And Larry Marshall is sitting in his office with all the other lawyers, and Anthony Porter's going to be executed. And they say, you know what? He has a low IQ. Mitigation wasn't put in. Maybe we can appeal to the governor and get a pardon, because that's the only way to save his life. Just the way lawyers talk, right? Just the way we think as lawyers. And David is in the room, and he says, you know what? And who's really looked at the innocence question? And I've spent a lot of time with David in rooms where he just keeps on saying to us lawyers, what makes you think your investigative system is so damn good in these cases? Why aren't you seeing how basically corrupt the process is in terms of representation and all these other factors that we detail in the book? So he said, let's look at the innocence question. He assigns Sean Ombrist, an 18-year-old journalism student, and some of her colleagues to go out and look in Anthony Porter's case. And they do the first thing that you learn as a public defender. They go back to the scene, and they realize that the witness who testified against Porter at the trial couldn't have said what she said. And they go back and they find her years later, while he's 2 days from execution. And she then indicates, oh, I was covering up for my ex-husband. I didn't see this at all. And then they go to the ex-husband, and they get a confession. And within 4 months, this man, who came within 2 days of execution, is off death row. Now, why is the system depending on her? All right, that's a problem for the system. But what about all the people in this room? I suggest to you it is a far better thing to start going across this country, whether you're a journalism student or a law student, and avoid the dot-coms, right? Avoid the easy, you know, and quick fortunes, the investment bankers. You're going to do a lot better and learn a lot more and help this society if you go out and take a look at some of these cases, and we'll learn a lot more from it.
Could I support Barry and Peter in a slightly different way along the line I began before? If lawyers do not struggle against it, then the element in the law which is the ordering element, the element that demands social peace, will win because all state power is in that direction. And the object of defense lawyers, of lawyers like the one sitting at this table, is precisely to oppose that power, which is overwhelming in the hand of the state, because it is the interest of the state to maintain peace and order. And it is only the lawyer with, if you like, the passion for justice, who stands between the power of the state and the individual. That's the real lesson. Not that there isn't a contradiction, but the two different sets of forces are operating here, and that's why we need defense lawyers.
And I can only tell you that at least the prosecutors that we've encountered who resisted DNA typing in a post-conviction context, the prosecutors who invented new theories of the case, such as the unindicted co-ejaculator, as a purpose, for the purpose of resisting a vacatur of that conviction. Those prosecutors did not have a passion for justice. Those prosecutors had a passion for rules. They had a passion for closure. They had a passion for the doctrine of finality, but they certainly did not ever evince a passion
for
justice.
But that's really dangerous, I think. I mean, it really is dangerous to assume that your adversaries, that you are concerned about justice and your adversaries aren't.
Why just resist doing the test? What in the world?
I'm not.
All these guys are resisting doing the test. That's not about justice.
I'm not defending them.
That's putting their head in the sand.
I'm not defending them.
I don't think it's presumptuous to say they're not about justice when they refuse to do these tests.
I don't know why I'm sort of.
You got stuck with this role.
How did you get yourself into this role?
But I do want to say something. Let's suppose for a moment that all of the reforms that Barry and Peter and Jim propose are put in place, and let's suppose that we in fact stop convicting innocent people. And I'm in favor of the reforms. I think they're good, and I agree completely about what Barry just said about people becoming defense attorneys. I was one myself, and I think I just agree with that. Still, the fact of the matter is that the problem with our criminal justice system, the main problem, is not that it's convicting the innocent. That is a problem, and I'm in favor of doing what we can to fix it. But the real problem is what we're doing to the guilty. There are, in this country right now, close to 2 million people locked up. We have the longest sentences of any civilized country, supposedly civilized. We have the most people per capita locked up. We have the most brutality. And that's something that's done, by and large, to people who did something, but shouldn't be treated the way they're treated. If you think that law ought to destabilize, one sort of trouble I have with this project, or a reservation about it, is that if all of the reforms that they're proposing were adopted, that might make the situation still worse. That is to say, we might then say, well, now we know all these people are guilty, let's execute all the bastards.
We're not going to be able to do that kind of quick fix, however, because aside from all the very specific problems and causes of unjust convictions, which we enumerate in the book, there is one other problem which sort of runs through all of them as a common thread, and that's race. For instance, what we see here is that almost half of these unjust convictions, half of the 64 cases now, where people have been convicted and then cleared by DNA evidence, involve black men who are convicted of raping white women. Now, nationwide, most rapes that are reported are committed within a race. That is, black men raping black men and white men raping white women. Very few, relatively speaking, are cross-racial. Yet here we see almost half of these unjust convictions, black men raping white women. Now, of course, a large part of that may be due to the particular problems of cross-racial identification. But regrettably, what we observe when we look at the data is that all those other factors, bad lawyers, bad prosecutors, jailhouse snitches, lousy scientists, all of them increase with frequency when it's a black man in the dock charged with raping a white woman. And that's not an easy fix.
All right, so let me bring this to a close by asking Bill Kovach, our journalist, to give us a wrap, Bill. What does it mean? What did we learn tonight? Give us the benediction.
I think this just demonstrates how difficult it is for the simplest reform to be embraced when you talk about the criminal justice system. I mean, here's a book that demonstrates beyond a reasonable doubt, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that a miscarriage of justice was perpetrated time and again. There is documented detail on what that miscarriage was. The simplest next step to take is when these things happen, let's examine step by step where the system failed. identify the people who failed, and let's make sure they don't have a chance to do it again, and that the system itself recognizes time after time after time where it went astray. We're never going to eliminate human failure. I mean, everything is flawed. Everything, no one ever finds the truth. But when we know we're wrong, we should do something to correct it and forget about all the other conversation at this minute and take a step we know we can take.
Would you join me in thanking the panel as a whole? And in particular, would you join me again in just saying thanks to some lawyers who really have a passion for justice? Now, the floor is open for questions. I have a microphone here. I welcome... Tell us who you are.
My name is Marty Pertikin. I'm a third-year student. This question is primarily for Mr. Scheck, but for any of the panelists. I'm wondering if you fear that the O.J. Simpson case, which was one of the first highly publicized cases to have DNA as a major issue in it, served to undermine public acceptance of DNA evidence as a legitimate form of proving the truth.
Well, there's not much good that came out of the political came out of the O.J. Simpson case for the political justice system, but there is one potential silver lining, and that is that the attack on DNA evidence in that case did not involve the reliability of DNA testing per se, its theory or its actual implementation by the FBI, the Department of Justice of California. The point that was made is that the way the people collected the evidence, handled it, processed it, and put it to the lab was all wrong. And what's interesting is that that critique has been accepted by the forensic community overwhelmingly. And that I even have a pamphlet here that what every law enforcement officer ought to know about DNA testing that says, change your gloves, don't put anything in a plastic bag that's wet, et cetera, which was like the cross-examination of those evidence handlers. And Peter and I have been, we are commissioners of justice in the state, commissioners of forensic science, I'm sorry, in the state of New York, where we actually have a agency that regulates the laboratories and the DNA data banks, tries to proficiency test the labs, and we actually train the officers now. So the best thing is that labs across the country are now moving to be accredited, and forensic scientists, I think, are taking much more seriously that you can ruin a 21st century technology that has so much to offer the system if you just don't handle the evidence correctly. And hopefully that lesson is being learned at both, that's the only good thing I can see coming out of the case. So in a funny way, it may be helped, because when that lesson is learned, you in a sense save the reliability of DNA.
Can I just say one point on that too, is that none of these cases involve anything like the kinds of collection issues and all that stuff that was involved in Simpson. These are much more straightforward, clear-cut issues about which there is little dispute on their
But meeting. the question was, didn't your conduct in the O.J. case undercut the credibility of DNA evidence at the very same time when you're advancing the credibility of DNA evidence as your weapon in the Innocence Project? Well, Peter, can you speak to that?
Whether Barry's conduct created that?
Yes, right, exactly.
You have to understand, we're commissioners now, but we want to be law lords.
It's a good job.
You know what? Actually, not only is Barry right when he talks about what, in fact, we did do, which was simply never call into question the legitimacy of DNA testing, but rather these other preliminary and threshold issues. The problem, to the extent that there is a misperception about what was done, rests with people who are sitting to the left and to the right, not these people in particular, but the press and the pundits who cover these cases and sometimes spin it a certain way or distort what actually transpires in the courtroom to serve some other purpose. But there's no question that what Barry said is accurate, that we did nothing to undermine the respect for DNA. That was not our purpose. That was not our intent. That's not what we were objectively doing. To the extent that someone walks away from the trial with that kind of, you know, conclusion, I can't control that. It's unfortunate. It's not correct. It's not accurate.
I hope everybody in this room understands that there's a fundamental asymmetry between exculpation by DNA evidence and declaring someone guilty by DNA evidence, because exculpation is not as problematic at all as trying to support the claim that the person was the perpetrator of the crime. It's a completely different issue. And there's good reason to be suspicious of laboratory work, of probabilities and so on, in the case where the DNA evidence is used to incriminate somebody. Those reasons are almost non-existent for the use of DNA as an exculpatory device.
Excellent point. Excellent. Sir.
My name is Adam A. Banja. I'm a first-year student here. I have a question generally for the whole panel, insofar as you can help with this. We've heard a lot about prosecutors who are resistant to looking into these things again, whether out of a misplaced sense of justice or to protect their own hides or whatever. What I was wondering was this, in your experience, are the judiciary invested in keeping the lid on these things? Do they find these things embarrassing? And if they do, does that tend to lead them to turn a blind eye to things that perhaps they ought not to?
I think the case in Chicago makes that fairly evident. When the judges who reverse cases on the basis of prosecutorial misconduct expunge the names of the prosecutors from the file, so they're held harmless for their behavior. It's a system that's designed to protect itself against mistakes, protect itself for responsibility against having to accept responsibility for mistakes. And I think those are the areas where it would seem to me that it makes sense to begin to move now to try to rectify that part of the system which is so patently in the wrong.
Let's go to another question.
Hi. My name is Kathleen Kozakiewicz, and I'm from New York City, by the way, so I kind of have an idea of what you folks have been experiencing down there. I also am a participant in Centurion Ministries in Princeton, New Jersey, and I have found this to be a very, very enlightening experience since I've been part of this. All I've been hearing this evening is almost a sense of disbelief that this could not possibly happen to me, that this is something that will happen to someone else, and somehow or another, this is never going to touch me, where I've had at least four friends who have been in this situation and someone has committed suicide over this. So this has profoundly affected me. I'd like to know, in your work and everything, basically how have people responded to this, and why do we continue to disbelieve you and everyone else who brings this forth, that this couldn't be. We live in supposedly in a democracy, and we're innocent until we're proven guilty, and I'm not convinced of that anymore.
You know, you raise a very compelling point. When people ordinarily think of these folks, they said, oh, these are people you're dealing with who have lengthy criminal records, and that's why they were sucked into the system, and that's why these miscarriages occurred. The truth is, if you look at the people in our book, Actual Innocence, almost none of them had any kind of criminal record at all. They're all incredibly ordinary people. One is an oyster fisherman from the Chesapeake Bay. Another is a Marine corporal from Santa Ana, California. A third man repairs oil burners in Virginia. His only prior involvement with the law was that he played basketball in the schoolyard after it had closed. These are very ordinary people who, for whatever reason, had this extraordinary Kafkaesque kind of thing happen to them, where they're literally plucked out of their families, plucked out of their jobs. Many of them had as alibis loved ones, parents, wives, sisters, brothers who were home with them, who actually went into court and said they were with us. And defendants who testified on their own behalf all disbelieved.
Question.
My name is George Bryant. I'm supporter of the Revolution Books here in Harvard Square. I wanted to cite this case in Pennsylvania, a man on death row, Mumia Abu-Jamal, where the classic symptoms are there. Didn't have the funds for the expert witnesses, didn't have proper representation. There was instances of police coercion, phony confessions, all this junk, and it's being played out now. It's going to the Federal Court of Appeals. But these patterns, which hasn't been talked about enough, about people on the bottom in society, racial and class, victims of a society that never really cared about their lives to begin with, and there's no indication that leading politicians today do either. But I think this case is going to be one test of the ability of people who seek justice for the people who've been on the bottom. Will this man be executed, or will he win a new trial? Will he be exonerated? Have you followed the case? Do you have any opinion about it?
Thanks.
Who is he asking?
Now, I know the case, but I'm not sufficiently knowledgeable about the law. The only issue in that I've been involved with or been asked about or to think about was National Public Radio cut him off from a series of broadcasts. And that decision, as I understand it, I had been on the board of National Public Radio, not at this time, but I checked it when it happened. Their decision was that they were being asked to commit to 13 consecutive programs that he would broadcast from prison right at the time when the appeal was pending, and they decided that they could allow a certain amount of access to public radio, but not 13 consecutive broadcasts. I think that's the only issue I'm aware of. The whole question of the right to make your case. I agree. It raises the question. I was not part of the decision, but I was just explaining what I understand the decision was made.
Question up here.
My name is Arez, and I graduated from law school in 1998. My friend Sid is a doctor, and he also has a question, but I'll ask mine first. And mine is actually directed to Professor Nesson. In your famous Harvard Law Review article, The Evidence or the Event, you suggest, and please correct me if I'm summarizing you incorrectly, that the legal system is heavily invested in casting verdicts as statements about what happened, or as statements about the truth, as opposed to as statements about the evidence or as probabilistic statements about how we should assess the evidence. I agree with that. I think that's right. And I'm curious to hear your views about how the advent and proliferation of DNA testing, both after trial, in circumstances such as the Innocence Project, and within trial, as DNA evidence becomes more part and parcel of the trial process, will affect the legal system's ability to describe verdicts in that way, whether verdicts will continue to be able to be described as statements about the truth and as statements about what happened, and if not, if that becomes more troublesome for the legal system to do, what you predict will happen, how the legal system will handle that that undermining.
Well, I think there's no question that the law flies under the flag of truth and will continue to do so. I don't think the law can be perceived as legitimate unless it's grounded in a perception that it connects with reality. Now, that's a rhetorical presentation that the law makes. And the fact is that the past is lost in mystery most of the time. So that when you get the mystery revealed with some magic like the advent of DNA, yes, the law faces a very serious rhetorical problem. If you personify the law, then the law's credibility is its power. And what do I think happens? The law has got to respond. The traditional way the law has always responded is set up process. Some process. Mike's observing quite correctly that sometimes process reestablishes credibility for something that can be a real problem. One of my first jobs as a lawyer was to work for the Joint Committee of the Massachusetts House and Senate in a corruption investigation. into the building trades and how the bribes worked. And one of the wonderful things I found was there had been 6 prior episodes of big investigations like that in past history, each one of which put in place yet another commission process, step in the process that one had to go through in order to get the ticket paid. And what happened was that each one successively became corrupt, so that instead of paying off one, you paid off 6. Process. I think the law is process, and it aspires to be as credible as possible. And in the end, the lesson is, we are the law. People who go out of this school, we are the law. People who go out of law schools, people are the law. It's up to us to actually resist this temptation to accept unreality and insist on something that's quality.
More process.
I think so, yes.
Can I add a point here? And that is that I'm so gratified that Bill has taken up this idea of the Innocence Commissions, because if we want to walk away from the DNA experience now, this moment of actual innocence, to choose a phrase, you know, it is a bit different when you have this set of cases where you say with, you know, a very high degree of scientific certainty, they didn't do it. And, you know, ordinarily in the criminal justice system, somebody's acquitted, they just say, didn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. We've had so many barriers, frankly, in 33 states, there are statute of limitations of 6 months or less on motions for newly discovered evidence of innocence. So in some ways, this is a new game. So if there is a process that emerges from this interesting moment, I would like to see this Innocence Commission, because it is a kind of new idea, and why don't we have it? It is simply saying, let's be accountable when we can be sure that a mistake was made. And why it may be politically viable is that, A, we know it was an injustice, a wrongful conviction, and B, we don't know who did it. It's not like, here are these defense lawyers, right, or liberal law professors or whatever, that are coming in and saying this. We don't know whether it was the defense lawyer, whether it was a bad judicial ruling, whether it was, you know, a bad forensic scientist or a cop or whomever, right? The prosecutor. Let's find out whether one or all, or it was just a mistake. And that is an even-handed system. It's one that people understand. It makes common sense. It's what we do with every other institution where the life and liberty of citizens is in the balance. And interestingly, maybe this one has a shot. So if you're asking me what process could emerge from this moment, I'd like to see that one.
And let me just add one point, because out of this, a process like this would at least arise a sense that there was some effort to retain respect for the process of the law itself, if you did this.
Yes. Doctor.
I'm a physician about to graduate from Harvard Medical School. I refer to the recent trial at the National Institutes of Health, which basically implicated physicians as being responsible for most of the illnesses that people experience in hospitals. We've spoken extensively about the use of science as a piece of evidence or as suggestive of evidence. My question is to the entire panel about whether you see scientific method coming into law in general and where that will lead us. In particular, I'm thinking about experiments or processes which will test exactly the kind of internal logic of the criminal justice system and be carried out just like physicians have learned to live with experiments. They will have numbers about culpability of perpetrators. And I'm just wondering where you see this ending up. Is there a possibility that we can re-examine the law the way we have started to re-examine medicine and science?
Wait, let me get it straight. You mean that when we get to the point of verdict, the judge will say, jury, have you reached your verdict? And they'll say, yes, guilty. And then the judge will say, you are probably guilty. You are, the 16 out of 19 chances that you're guilty. And on that basis, we will execute you.
Well, I actually actually mean a process more akin to the fact that before the jury comes in to reach its verdict, it functions with the information that 16% of the time when juries reach their verdict in a randomized trial, they actually reached an incorrect verdict based on a certain set of evidence. Or 27% of a time when a black man was implicated in the rape of a white woman, the jury reached an incorrect verdict based on scientific evidence.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, 16 out of 19 times you reach a wrong verdict. Now I charge you, retire and find the verdict beyond a reasonable doubt.
I don't know. I don't think it's going to work.
However, we have a lot of evidence about the understanding of laypersons about probability statements. A lot of evidence, and it's pretty dismal. It takes me a whole semester to teach Harvard undergraduates, after all, the elements of statistics. How you propose to instruct a jury, or a judge for that matter, in the niceties of the difference between prior probability, posterior probability, Bayesian inference, likelihood, and so on, I don't know. We know, for example, that when genetic counselors counsel people by saying, well, I've discovered that you have a 1 in 4 chance of having an affected child of this disease, a not inconsiderable portion of such couples say to the counselor, well, it doesn't matter because I'm going to have 2 children. Now, you may find that laughable, but that is the, I mean, many of you in this room believe in the law of averages. You think if somebody who's batting 300 hasn't had a hit in 5 or 10 times at bat, he's due, right? I mean, I think it's quite hopeless to suppose that one can do that.
There's a tremendous amount of social science research going on about trials and juries, and I think it's fair to say that the law has mostly been resistant to things that we've discovered. Just two examples that occur to me. There's now lots of evidence that judging credibility on the basis of the appearance of a witness is actually probably worse than chance. And yet the law places a tremendous amount of trust in the ability of jurors to look at witnesses and make judgments about whether they're telling the truth. And something that is close to the Innocence Project, there's a lot of scientific evidence that indicates that eyewitness identification is essentially worthless. What's really shocking, and a reform that I'd like to suggest you add to your list, in many jurisdictions, that scientific evidence is inadmissible. So the jury is not allowed to be told that these judgments are fallible. Or worse than fallible. I don't think there's any excuse for that.
Let's do one last question. Tell us who you are.
My name is Rebecca Nordhaus. I'm a 1L. And this is a question for the Innocence Project folks. You all talk about the liberating power of the DNA testing. I wonder what you think about Giuliani's proposal to test people who, I don't know, whether it was who had just been arrested or had been convicted last year or the year before.
Arrested.
And let's just put it in context of a very interesting event in the past, I don't know, a week ago, in which DNA winds up nailing.
Oh, sure.
From 1979.
Absolutely. The short answer to your question is that I'm opposed to taking DNA samples from people at arrest. And an understanding of how this system works. We now have in every state legislation setting up DNA databanks. And the way that works in virtually every state is that there's authorization to take a DNA sample from someone that is convicted of a violent felony, for the most part, or a felony, and you take their DNA pattern and you stick it in the databank. Then the theory is, when a new crime is committed, you will be able to look, extract DNA evidence from the relevant crime scene samples and stick that in the databank, see if it matches another a convicted offender, or if it matches another crime in another area, so you get what they call a scene-to-scene hit. Unfortunately, in this country, the capacity of the DNA laboratories is terrible. They just don't have the capacity to do testing, for example, 7 to 10 days after a crime is committed. Even worse, we have a lot of old unsolved crimes. where you have rape kits, for example, in the New York City Medical Examiner's office, 12,000 of them that were sitting there without anybody having been arrested for anything, and they weren't doing DNA typing on them. And after 5 years, just throwing them away. So obviously you want to do typing on those kinds of samples, and you're going to get serial rapists, serial murderers. You'll be able to solve old unsolved crimes. You want to do that for homicides. So we are so backlogged and so far behind in doing these essential things to make the technology work. I mean, when you test that sample from a crime scene within 7 to 10 days after the crime is committed, what you are doing is eliminating the wrong suspect right away. So the police don't get down the path of trying to fit somebody, you know, for the crime that they didn't commit. You get rid of the wrong suspect right away. You protect the innocent, and at the same time, it leads you on the path of identifying the real perpetrator better. So the technology, frankly, is not being adequately implemented at this time, and it would be a logistical nightmare with many civil liberties problems if we were to extend it at this point in time to taking it from people at arrest.
Aside from the pragmatic problems, there are some fundamental policy concerns. I mean, first of all, in fairness to the mayor, he didn't say we should simply type people at arrest. The mayor said we should type everybody at birth, and we should have a universal database in this country, out of fairness to him. Now the problem is, and you really have to approach this thing in some kind of cost-benefit analysis. It's one thing to take specimens from convicted felons who have obviously demonstrated a certain ability to commit a particular kind of crime, and where biological evidence may play a role in capturing them in the future. It's something else when you're talking about arrestees. But when you're talking about the universal database that the mayor has recommended, you worry particularly in this country, not just about important privacy rights, but because DNA, unlike fingerprints, can reveal so much more about a person, such as, you know, predispositions for certain kinds of disorders, that we have to remember that the whole eugenics movement did not start in Germany, it started in this country, that there's a history of genetic discrimination in this country, and that we have to be very, very vigilant about people taking these DNA specimens without the kinds of rigorous controls as to who can have access to them, and going off and doing research. It may sound pretty far-fetched at this point in time, but there's an historical record of it happening, and there is a lot of people in this country who are concerned about that. And when you couple that with the reality of a large number of people in this country being arrested, for instance, through racial profiling, you're not going to have a database that is fairly drawn from all segments of the society. You're going to be selecting particularly people of color, particularly poorer people, and if they do the kind of research, it raises some very, very serious concerns.
Well, would you once again join me in thanking this excellent panel? And thank you all, and good night.